The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with the legendary bassist Pino Palladino, an artist so prolific he's played with everyone from The Who to D'Angelo. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. And speaking of D'Angelo, we've got a classic album dissection of his 2000 masterpiece, Voodoo.
Take you with my two shot, control you with my drop.
Take him out.
Raise you with my handle, impress you with my pride.
That's a little bit of the song Playa Playa by D'Angelo, the first track off his 2000 album Voodoo. Today, we're doing a classic album dissection of that record. The story of Voodoo and what followed is absolutely fascinating.
It absolutely is, Craig. Before we dive into talking about the record, let's give some background about who D'Angelo is as an artist. He's born Michael Eugene Archer in 1974, grew up in Richmond, Virginia, the surrounding area, came up in the church as the son of a Pentecostal preacher, and fell in love with music, especially classic soul, R&B, and funk. And you can hear those influences all over his songs. Was originally part of that neo-soul movement. People in that genre getting back to, recording with real instruments away from synthesized productions. After being a member of a couple of different groups, he signed in 1991, age 17, to EMI. And he worked as a songwriter until his debut in 1995, the Brown Sugar record.
Now, Brown Sugar was a huge hit, Jim, and many felt at the time that this young artist, D'Angelo, was taking up the mantle from greats like Marvin Gaye with those sultry vocals and those very soulful songs. But around this time, he took a step in a different direction. He joined the musical collective The Soulquarians, which included artists like Questlove, J Dilla, Erykah Badu, Common, Mos Def, and Q-Tip, to name just a few.
His next album, his number two album, Voodoo, is the reason we are here today. It didn't come out until 5 years after Brown Sugar. He was experiencing some serious writer's block, and he felt the pressure from his label and the public to release new music that upped the ante on what he had done previously. It took a while, but eventually we got Voodoo, which was well worth the wait. At least you and I thought so. I remember us talking endlessly in 2000 about how mystical, magical, entrancing this album was. 13 tracks, iconic songs like Devil's Pie, Send It On, and Feel Like Making Love. It didn't, however, have the commercial impact that Brown Sugar had. It's weirder, it's more experimental, but it still added to his status as a sex symbol, which at times threatened to overshadow the music.
Yeah, that's true, Jim. And to take a deeper look at Voodoo, we're joined by Faith Penick. Faith is a filmmaker and writer, and also an author of a fantastic 33 and a third book on Voodoo. She's a fan of this record and an expert on it. Welcome to Sound Opinions, Faith.
Thank you both for having me.
Voodoo, I think, is the dirtiest record ever made. Not dirty as in salacious, but I put this album on and I smell the chicken grease. I smell it frying, man. You know, it's like, this is a dirty gumbo is the word you used, you know, and very carnal, but not in a misogynistic way.
Right. It's interesting because I don't think of Voodoo as dirty. I guess it defined dirty because I think people hear dirty and of course they think sex.
I'm talking about chicken grease and rolling in the swamp. Mud.
So you're talking about dirt in a metaphorical sense. No, I mean, in that sense, yeah. I think you're correct. He's Southern. He's a Southern boy. And I think the album embraces that. I think it embraces his experiences as a young Black man. It's got to be sort of dirty and sort of raw because life is dirty and raw. You know, life is not polished. I mean, stuff happens and it can get messy and there are things you can't control and it will F up your life, you know? So let me tell you about the chicken grease. Stuff some things to make the people get out the seat.
Everybody is good if they wanna clap your hands. You mentioned the word dirty and chicken grease came up with that song. Faith, but I think you get at the reasons why the album sounds that way by sort of the textural components and the way the music was played. The groove being slower than people would anticipate for a contemporary R&B record. Playing behind the beat, the willingness to sort of tolerate mistakes. What was the beginning point of that sort of way of thinking? I mean, they clearly were not wanting to make a straight-up commercial R&B record. When did that become clear that that had to be the direction?
I think it's pretty clear that he did a complete 180 from Brown Sugar. Let me tell you about this girl, maybe I should. I met her in Philly and her name was Brown Sugar. See, we've been making love constantly. That's why my eyes are a shade, blood burgundy. I think he, D'Angelo himself, probably felt like, wow, you know, I've got more in me. I have more interesting things to say, more intricate ways to express my musicality, my emotions, and that Brown Sugar was scratching the surface. And I think this is where his friendship with Russell Elovato, his engineer, he met Russell Elovato, ironically, through his ex, Angie Stone, and D'Angelo was looking for someone to replace Bob Power to mix the rest of Brown Sugar, which was still unfinished at the time. So Russell Elovato came on, they hit it off immediately, they were like, you know, two brothers from different mothers, and, you know, I think Elovato really encouraged D'Angelo to, you know, push the envelope and really, you know, sort of get more raw, nastier, not as pristine, not as polished as Brown Sugar is, you know, but really sort of, you know, embrace the dirt, if you will. Love the slide, want the pie, why is why, till we fry, watch us all, stand in line, more slice of the devil's pie, drugs and thugs, when it's wine, three or four at a time, watch them all, stand in line. And I think that was their intent from the very beginning, and they brought on people who were in sync with that. D'Angelo hired musicians who are, you know, at the time were, in some cases still are, at the top of their game and were open to improvisation and, like you said, playing behind the beat. I mean, Pino Palladino, who played bass on a lot of the album, talked about, and that was hard for him because he necessarily an easy thing for him to do. He was like, I don't know what this is, but I will figure it out. Would it be all right? I love to kiss you, baby, once again. He can play whatever he wants. I mean, he's just that good and that versatile. And that's why D'Angelo wanted him on the album, similar to Charlie Hunter, who's another, you know, great bass and guitar player who comes out of the jazz tradition. Ditto Roy Hargrove, Roy Hargrove, James Poyser. The lineup he had are, you know, he just had people who could just play what, if you say play this in you know, in this time signature, you know, in this way, you know, standing on your head on fire, they would be able to, they're like, yes, okay, we can do that.
Yeah.
To be able to attract musicians of that caliber on your album says a lot about you as an artist, and that it proves, you know, that, you know, D'Angelo is an artist that pretty much anybody who's good enough or, you know, would want to work with. But also it just shows how open-minded they were as far as like, yes, we want to do some different thing. We, you know, it's a it's a brilliant album, but it's also a fun album to listen to, because you just feel the passion is so there. It's not, there's not a false note or false sense of emotion on that album.
A big component of D'Angelo's image at this time was his sexuality. It was in the music, as well as in videos like the one for Untitled, How Does It Feel?, in which he is, gasp, shirtless. In your book, Faith, you talk about how women and many others loved that video. One thing I didn't realize was how many people, specifically black men, thought D'Angelo was gay.
Well, I don't know. Either they thought he was gay or they just resented him to no end. They were so put off by what they perceived as homoerotica that, you know, because here's this man with no shirt on, presumably naked, singing directly into the camera, and they're like, well, what is this? But here's the thing, though, and this is what I always find interesting about it, is that he wasn't, D'Angelo wasn't the only black man with no shirt on in a music video at that time. You had LL Cool J made his career, you know, on being shirtless in music videos.
Never, you know, wearing a shirt.
Yeah, he never wore a shirt. Did he own a shirt? I mean, you know, ditto, yeah. DMX, ditto Tupac, yeah. Ditto. I mean, I can go down a list of, I think Jodeci. I mean, just how many black men had their shirts off in music videos and no one cared? But, oh my God, Untitled comes out. And I think this is why black men got mad and wanted to call D'Angelo gay, because they couldn't deal with it. They were mad because that video was made for the female gaze. It was made for women to look at, particularly black women, and the black boyfriends, husbands, significant others, fathers. They just couldn't deal with, they just were like, well, why are you watching? You know, because women would like shush people when that video came on, like wherever they were. They were just in, you know, they would be like, get out of my room or get out of my house. And I'm feeling right on, feel the same.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though, and I'm obviously talking from a white male perspective, but I also think there is a sexuality that is, so you're talking as a woman who's being struck by that, but it almost transcends male or female, like some of those voodoo gods, and you see the statues, right? The icons, you don't know, are they male, are they female? It's just like raw sex, period.
No, that's a very good point, Jim. And again, this is, I think it's a difference from like a lot of the other men that I mentioned, the performers who had their shirts off. I think in this case, D'Angelo was like, you know, instead of being aggressive, he was being submissive. He was like, you can have me. I am yours. This is for you. And I think that is the difference. So that, to me, that extends beyond sex and sex appeal. That's about, like, so again, submission and saying, I am giving myself to you. And that's why black women, and I mean women across races, but women in general, yeah, just lost their minds. But black women in particular, like, because there was just nothing, nobody was singing to women on MTV. Like, none of these music, I mean, not in that way. It was very like, yeah, you can, you know, I'm going to do this to you and da 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 da. And it was, again, very sort of, you know, very masculine in your face. Whereas this was like, it's in your face, but in a different way. And we just weren't used to that. You know, but I think it's a sexuality that was nuanced. And I think, frankly, that got lost in the conversation around the entitled video.
I think there's so many misinterpretations of the nuances in there. And I feel like your book alludes to the idea that those got lost, especially on the subsequent concert tour.
Yes.
Where I think he started to feel that he was being perceived as this sexual being, and that was it. And everybody else was sort of missing the layers that were in his music. I mean, and boy, there was a series of meltdowns and arrests after that.
Yeah.
I mean, can we really draw that line from that sense of they're missing the point to, you know, I'm going silent for the next two decades, basically?
yeah, I can. I did so in the book. I think definitely the pressure of being, I mean, it makes me think of the saying, you know, be careful what you wish for because you might get it. And when he made mm-hmm. the Untitled video, which was his ex-manager's idea, the late Dominique Trenier, and he did it, Trenier and D'Angelo did it because they wanted him to make a splash. They didn't just want Voodoo to come out and rest on its laurels as an album, which obviously it could have, and it does. But they wanted MTV eyeballs. They wanted BET eyeballs. They wanted it to be a sensation. So the Untitled video was made, and unfortunately, I do think that the video overshadowed the Voodoo album. And so, yes, when he went on tour, when D'Angelo went on tour in 2000, and I saw him twice on that tour, and there were women in the front rows screaming, take it off, throwing panties on stage, grabbing at him, trying to rip his clothes off. And I think, yeah, at a certain point, he got tired of that because, first and foremost, he is a musician. He's a singer. He's an artist. D'Angelo wants to be taken seriously. He's not just there to be ogled at and sort of touched like he's, you know, a Ken doll. And it's funny because, you know, and actually I interviewed his current manager, Alan Leeds, for the book. And he said at the time, he was his tour manager for the Voodoo tour in 2000. And he said, I thought D'Angelo would like this. I mean, what man wouldn't like to be the focus of all of these women who want to sleep with you? I mean, but I think Leeds and Trenier underestimated D'Angelo's sensitivity, and they didn't prepare him for it. And so, yeah, it really took its toll because he couldn't just be, when you hit that level of fame, you can't just go home and just be normal and be Michael again.
Africa is my descent. Here I'm far from home. I dwell within a land that's meant for many men, not my tone.
But that D'Angelo tour was something. That's one that I'll never forget because it was just spectacular.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've seen him since. I mean, obviously he's come back, and the shows have been good, but that was a singular tour. There were so many complex emotions going through him at the time. I think that's why we got the show we got back then.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, he was working out a lot of things in real time. I mean, superstardom, and I'm not sure who he was dating at the time, but I'm sure that was probably a part of it because love, you know, romantic love always seems to be a part of D'Angelo's musical, you know, expression. You know, and I think when he toured at that point, he had had a second child. So, I mean, yeah, he was dealing with a lot of stuff, and, you know, at still, again, a very young age, and, you know, working that out while still touring, while still promoting his album. And I think that took its toll. And I think he just decided, you know what, I'm peacing out on this. I'm not, you know, even when he came back, you know, in 2014 with Black Messiah, I mean, he toured, you know, but he did not, you know, do a lot of press. And, you know, I think at this point, mm-hmm. he pretty much is just like shut down as far as the, you know, doing any kind of promotional work for any.
You know, to what extent, Faith, do you think it was like Brian Wilson made Pet Sounds, Kevin Shields made Loveless with My Bloody Valentine, you know, Jeff Mangum made those two Neutral Milk Hotel records, all considered masterpieces, all followed by like two decades each of silence, or in Wilson's case, just very sporadic output, you know? I mean, do you think he knew I created one of the best albums of all time? not just in the genre of R&B or soul, right, or whatever you want to go. And like, how the hell do I follow this up? I don't know. I'm going on vacation.
yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I did not, and I tried to, but I did not interview D'Angelo for this book. I would have loved to. I don't know. I mean, just speaking for myself, I don't know how you follow up something like Voodoo. I mean, to me, you know, that is his pinnacle. That is, I don't, and I mean, when Black Messiah came out in 2014, I like the album. I think it's good, but it's not Voodoo. I mean, to me, no. And it's obvious that he sort of picked up where Voodoo left off. And it's funny because I know a lot of people who are like, I love Black Messiah. They love that album. And I think in a way, because, you know, they had time, you know, they were able to catch up to Voodoo. They had like basically a decade and a half to have Voodoo grow on them and sort of prepare them for Black Messiah. And so when Black Messiah came out, and also, you know, it's just sort of like, oh, okay. In a way, I mean, D'Angelo caught up with it because, you know, he put out Black Messiah in his mid-40s. So in a way, it's like, okay, now this is the album we would expect a mid-40s genius to put out, as opposed to someone in his early 20s. I don't know. I don't know if that was, I mean, I know he had writer's block even when he was writing Voodoo, and that's part of why it took so long to finish. So I wouldn't be shocked if writer's block didn't, I mean, on top of depression and having losses in his personal life and just all of the post-Voodoo, post-Untitled stuff that really sort of rained down on him. Yeah, it probably did. He probably was like, I'm just going to take a vacation for 10 some odd years.
20 years.
Yeah, I mean, well, right. You know? although I have to say, it wasn't just a vacation. I mean, you know, there were drugs, there were alcohol abuse and that horrible car crash in 2005 where I was worried like, oh God, this is the end. And, you know, I'm just glad. I mean, and honestly, I think if he never recorded another note, I was just glad that he survived that, just to be with his family and his children, the people who care about him. And, but yeah, so it got very dark. And so it wasn't just a vacation. It did get very dark. And I'm glad that at least it seems like right now he's healthy and, you know, still working on music.
We have been talking to Faith Panic, the author of Voodoo, deep dive into the making of that record. Faith, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you both for having me.
That wraps up our classic album dissection of Voodoo, and now we want to hear from you, our listeners. Do you think it holds up? What's your favorite track or memory from listening to that album? Let us know in our Facebook group or in our Patreon community. Or leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, so we can play it on the show. Coming up, our conversation with Voodoo bassist Pino Palladino on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we are back. This week, we're talking to legendary bassist Pino Palladino. Since the early 80s, Pino has made a name for himself as the go-to session and touring bassist for artists ranging from The Who and Nine Inch Nails to D'Angelo and Elton John, even John Mayer. The list goes on and on.
Pino, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thank you for having me.
You've worked with everybody and anybody, it seems like, over the last three decades.
What a resume.
I have no idea how, in the middle of all the work that you do, that you were able to put together a record of your own. Notes with attachments that you did with multi-instrumentalist and producer Blake Mills. How did you manage that?
Well, it took me 40 years. You just said it. I mean, you know, I think it's about time. I've been fortunate enough to stay, you know, extremely busy throughout my career, if not with recording, with touring and being parts of various touring setups over the years. And there never seemed to be enough time to really devote to a solo project. Plus, I didn't know what the hell to do, you know. I mean, what I do, it's kind of difficult to translate necessarily into a solo record. You know, I play in a lot of genres of music with lots of different artists, and I get to express myself through their music, but not in a virtuoso way, mostly. So you know, it's always been a conundrum for me as to how to approach a solo record. But it took a long time, but the timing was right.
Mm-hmm. So, Pino, one of the reasons we were interested in talking to you is we were doing a series of interviews with great session musicians. Your talents have fueled records by so many great artists. D'Angelo, Nine Inch Nails, Simon and Garfunkel, Don Henley, Gary Newman, Adele, John Mayer, Margot Price, right? I'm just writing down some of my favorites that you either recorded with or toured with. We wanted to get to a little bit of the gestalt of how you approach sessions with so many diverse artists. You know, do you go in with a mindset of I'm going to give them what they want, or they're calling me, they must want what Pino does, or how do you juggle that kind of variety?
Yeah, it's a really good question, which I haven't really analyzed much over the years. It's just something I do naturally now after such a long time. I think the first thing I look for is just communication channels. You know, that's what it's all about, with the producer and the artist, just to make sure there's nothing in the way, really. You know, that's my main concern when I get in the studio, is just establishing communication so that we can just get right to it and try and find the best thing for the music. That may be oversimplifying a little bit, because there's a lot of stuff that comes into play just in communication. But I don't really go in with an idea of what I'm going to play or how it's going to be. I'll take a bunch of instruments and just feel it out as the process evolves. Sometimes it could, you know, I'll hear a song that I'm going to play on and think, wow, I'm lucky to get to play on this. It's going to be a great song with or without me. I just have to not ruin it, you know? And other times I will hear a song and just think, wow, this was, you know, this could have been written for me to do my thing on. And I'll really get a chance to express something through it. And then there are times where there may be a time constraint and the studio clock is ticking away and you just get the feeling you need to get it done. Other times you just feel like you could be there for 3 days working on a bass track and it would be cool. So each case is different.
Bring that sort of multifaceted, you know, aspect to your record. I imagine working on all these different sessions, that's the thing that's always struck me as amazing, is that you can go from working with D'Angelo to The Who, and you find a way to make it work. The artists obviously trust you to do it, but is that ever daunting? Like, oh, I'm out of my depth here. There's something, this isn't a style of music that I'm not comfortable with. Has that ever happened to you?
No. I can usually...
That's great.
I mean, you know, it's not rocket science. It really isn't. Mm-hmm. It's. I know that's a cliche, but there's usually some sort of thread that I can find in whatever music I'm asked to be a part mm-hmm. of. You know, I can relate to something I've heard or music I grew up with and bring that into the music. And I've always been really conscious of wanting to play the right thing. It's probably just part of my personality. I just want to, you know, get it right. You know, whatever the genre is, fit into it and make it as good as it can be from my perspective.
Do you have these musicians telling you? I mean, does anybody say, play that Pino line that you do so well on such and such a record? And they want you to basically, like, make a carbon copy version of yourself for this record? Or do they kind of leave it up to you? Or do they give you very specific instructions about what they want, irrespective of what you've done in the past?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, as musicians or artists, we all want to be invited to play or participate in the project for what we're about to do, right? Not what we've done.
Right.
But it's not always that. Sometimes people, especially in the music industry, will call you because they've heard you play on something and they like what you did to that record and they're hoping that you can bring something similar to their record. So I'm always aware of that. It used to happen more back in the 80s when I was playing a lot of fretless bass and it was a very characterful sound, shall we say. You couldn't miss it, you know, it was there right in your face. There were times where I would go to play on records and somebody will have already put like a keyboard guide bass down playing my licks, you know, playing my fretless licks that they'd heard me playing on other records. So it became a sort of a vocabulary, really, in terms of a bass approach back then. And yeah, that used to be a bit tiresome, just going in and hearing what somebody thought you would play kind of thing.
Yeah, why bother to have you come in?
You know, and I would say that a few times. I'd say, you know what, it sounds great what you've done. Why don't you just keep it, you know?
Yeah.
Mm.
But yeah, that doesn't happen so often now. Most of the time, it's an open page for me to just, you know, come in and add something. I'm in a very fortunate position. I've built it up over many years, and I think, yeah, most people trust me to. They'll at least give me a chance to find something, and if it doesn't go the way they were hoping, then they can always pull me back in line and just say, well, we thought it could be more like this, and I'm always open to that.
Take us back to Wales and how Giuseppe becomes Pino. Why there's a Giuseppe in Wales, Cardiff, to begin with? I mean, I'm sure people are tripping right now because they expected, you know, an Italian accent, right? You know, a guy named Pino, a guy real named Giuseppe, should be talking like he's from Jersey, you know what I mean? Like me. Tell us about your upbringing. It's fascinating.
Yeah, so my dad was born in Italy in a relatively unknown part of Italy called Molise. The capital city is Campobasso. So I guess when he was in his early 20s, I think the time frame is pretty correct, he came over to the UK and eventually ended up in Cardiff, in Wales, to get some work in the steelworks just to work his passage to Canada. I think he was originally trying to get to Canada. But whilst in Wales working at the steelworks, he met my mum and, you know, he never left Cardiff, actually. Then he went on to work in the restaurant industry, as many Italians did, and set up his own restaurants. And so as a kid, I was always around, you know, kitchens and restaurants and worked in my dad's restaurants, you know, when I was in my early teens. And also, we used to rehearse upstairs, you know, my first band. My dad let us rehearse in the upstairs floors of the restaurant. So in Cardiff back in the 70s, there's a lot of different nationalities. It's a big docks area, right? So a lot of boats came in over the years, and so there's a lot of nationalities there, a lot of different influences musically. And I got to take all that in, you know, from sort of traditional rock and roll, you know, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, stuff like that. That was very big in all the bands in Cardiff back in my teens. And a little later on, I got into the reggae side of things and the soul and the R&B. But I grew up pretty much like most musicians at the time, playing Born to Be Wild on guitar and Stairway to Heaven and stuff like that. In Cardiff, where I grew up, there's an area in Cardiff, the Docks area, which was also known as Tiger Bay. There was a film about it, and you know, Shirley Bassey's from Cardiff too, and there's a story there. Tom Jones, I mean, you know, incredible.
It's a soulful place.
It is, man. It really is. Yeah, I like to think so. So I spend a lot of my years, my late teens and early 20s, you know, down in the docks area in sort of clubs where they would play a lot of reggae music and American funk and jazz and R&B. And even before that, Motown was my favorite. You know, I remember just, I went to a skating rink with the school when I was about 14. And that was the first time I heard really loud music. I couldn't believe it. They were playing Motown, Diana Ross and the Supremes and Junior Walker, stuff like that. They were playing it through a big PA at the skating rink, and that really did it for me. I was like, that got into my blood straight away.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with bassist Supreme Pino Palladino. He'll tell us what it was like to work with D'Angelo and talk about the phone call that led him to playing bass for The Who on almost no notice. That's next on Sound Opinions.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, alotrolado.org/volunteer.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we are back. And this week we are talking with bassist Pino Palladino about his illustrious career in music. Let's get back to that conversation.
The soul influence, when you mention that, and I think about you recording with D'Angelo, and your bass was so brilliant on those records, clearly valued by the people around you. Let me hit this up.
What was it like? I mean, the Soul Quarians, that was kind of like an interesting atmosphere they created, especially for the Voodoo record. What was it like walking into that recording session?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's amazing, really, because I was so at home. Guess I would have related to my early days in Cardiff, as I say, listening to R&B and playing that music. So, you know, move on however many years it was, from the early 70s to almost 2000, 1997. Meeting D'Angelo and working with that collective was really rewarding for me, as I felt that my roots in music, that was a big part of my roots in music. I never really had had the opportunity to fully express that side until I met those guys. So I think that's what it felt like home for me. And they're, you know, as a collective, they're just so generous and so welcoming. And there wasn't really much thought process, actually. It's very natural. You know, the first time I sat in the studio with D'Angelo and Quest, and we played together as a trio, It was almost like I wasn't even playing. It was just playing itself. It just felt very, very mm-hmm. natural. All the stuff I'd learned and listened to over the years seemed to just come out naturally at that point.
There's this cliche, Pino, in drum bass rhythm section lore. You know, I say this as a drummer who's been reading Modern Drummer since I was 12. English musicians, drummers and bassists, play behind the beat. Americans are on top of the beat. And there is that elastic feel. I've seen you talk about it in interviews. You're further behind the beat than you would normally have played. And D'Angelo wanted this kind of, it lets the music breathe in a different way. And I was wondering if they turned, let's get that tall white guy, because then, you know, because Questlove does what Questlove does, man, he's on it, you know, that snare, holy cow. Did they want that from you, or was that magic that happened in the studio?
You mentioned British rhythm sections, what did you say, more behind the beat, right? In America. Yeah, I was never aware of that. I never thought of it in that way, actually.
Yeah, and I never quite understood it. It's just something Modern Drummer always said.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. I don't know what to say about that. I've never really felt that that difference. Mm. But I think, you know, with working with D, it was a specific feel that, you know, if you hear D'Angelo sit down at the piano and play, you're going to hear that feel. He doesn't need anybody. You're going to hear that dimension in the rhythm. So the left hand will play a bass comp and the right hand will be doing the flourishes. And that rhythmic tension is already there. It's interwoven into his compositions.
Stems from him.
Yeah, totally. And really, it was just a way of translating that. So, you know, moving that forward to hear it with a drum beat and then adding a bass guitar to it. And as you say, it does give the music space because each instrument finds its own little dimension rhythmically.
Mm.
I mean, that's if you want to analyze it. If you don't analyze it, it just feels really good, right?
You just feel it.
Flipping 180 degrees, you are basically a member of the Who whenever they tour, get together.
When they convene.
Yeah. So you go from D'Angelo to the Who basically it's roughly in the same era here. Not only that, you're supposed to replace John Entwistle. What was that experience like for you?
Oh, yeah, that was really, I mean, God. I was already in it before I had a chance to think about that. You know, that was the whole thing. It was such a tragic, awful circumstance to get a gig. You know, to replace somebody who would tragically pass so suddenly.
And it was on like 3 days' notice, right?
Yeah, it was actually 3 or 4 days. Yeah, I was actually, at the time I was in Philadelphia and I was working on a record with Common. It was called Electric Circus, that was that album. Mm-hmm. And I'd arranged to leave Philly and fly back to London. I was in my hotel room packing and I phoned my wife and said, you know, I'll be home, you know, soon. And she said, oh, well, you just got a call from the Who's manager. And I said, what? And she told me what had happened. I hadn't heard about John, you know, and I was trying to take that in. And she said, sit tight. I gave him the hotel room number. And then Bill phoned me, Bill Kirbishley, and told me that he needed a yes or a no. Can I do the gig at the Hollywood Bowl in 3 or 4 days' time, whatever it was? And he needed to know there and then. There was a lot of stuff riding on it. So I agreed to do it and didn't really think any more than that. I made my decision really, I'd worked with Pete over the years and really love Pete. And it's just, you know, it's an honor to be asked to be the guy to fill in for John and try and play with the Who. So yeah, long story short, I flew into LA that day and Pete and Bob Pridden met me at the hotel. With a big stack of CDs, you know, like that.
Here's your homework.
Pretty much, yeah. And, you know, of course, it's one of the first records I ever bought was Won't Get Fooled Again. So, you know, I knew some of the music, but I certainly
didn't. You had a head start, yeah.
I didn't know all of it, that's for sure. And so the next, you know, that night, I arrived in LA around 10 or 11 at night and really stayed up until I couldn't stay awake anymore, learning as much as I possibly could of the songs I didn't know. At the time, they didn't say there was a set list, so it was really just learn as much as you can and we'll work it out. And the next thing you know, it's the gig at the Hollywood Bowl, and I'm in the van on the way to the gig. And it was just a roller coaster ride from then on in. I didn't really think about whether it would be a long-time gig. All I was doing was doing a few shows and seeing how it went. And it turned into 15 years.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And I think for me, one of the amazing things about it is that you stepped into that job and Entwistle's bass parts were so distinctive. He was the lead instrument on a number of songs. In fact, him and Keith Moon probably played more lead than Pete did sometimes,
yes.
It seemed like. How were you able to define your role, knowing that the fan expectation was to hear maybe certain notes here or this little bass fill there? How did you handle that situation?
Yeah, I mean, that's really, scary. That's a scary one. I mean, John was he was a unique player. I can't think of anyone. I mean, usually if you think of a bass style, you can think of somebody that can copy it, right, and do a version of it or is inspired by it. But I don't know anyone that sounds like John Entwistle before or after. Really, really unusual way of approaching the bass guitar. So I never for a minute thought I could do any of that stuff. I really don't have the chops and I don't have that technique to be able to pull that stuff off. So for me, it was more about learning the songs and the integral bass parts. The bass parts that I thought were a huge part of the compositions, I learned as much of those as I could. And the rest of the stuff, I just tried to approach it from just trying to support the song and probably play a lot more than I would normally play, because that's a part of the Who sound too. There's a lot going on, and it's impossible to replicate what they did, so I was just doing my best to support the songs really and play some of those signature lines that I could.
Mm-hmm. So if a Who song is all about everything going on all the time, when you play with an Adele, when you play with a Simon and Garfunkel, you back them up live. Is it I'm playing for the song?
Absolutely, yeah, I'm playing for the song. It's just a thing. I enjoy fitting into the genre, and it's like trying to unlock a door, just find out what it is that makes that music tick, and then try and find a way of putting some of my own character into that. But in the correct way, so I'm not going to play a crazy fusion jazz lick, on a Simon Garfunkel song,
Right. Well, so that I can understand now that we've been talking about so many aspects of your career, I can understand how notes with attachments is daunting. How am I myself now when there is no song for me to play? Unlock that key. Where do we go? So how would these tracks begin?
Various ways. Some of them I'd been sitting on for quite a while. Like one track in particular, Sound Walk, I had recorded a demo back in 2000 when I was playing with D'Angelo and Soultronics. And so that'd been around quite a while as a version on an MP3. That's all I had on that. Some of the other songs started life at my home studio in London with Chris Dave on drums, my rhythm section collaborator on quite a few projects. And we would just vibe on things, he's so creative and such a brilliant musician all around that we would just come up with ideas. And I carried those around on my hard drive for quite a while, like 3 or 4 years before we did anything for this record. Other songs were songs that were complete. With melody, intro, arrangements, everything was all there. So they varied, actually.
Exploring Afrobeat, I love that track. I'm going to butcher the pronunciation. Ikute?
Yeah, Ikute, that's good enough.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I love that track.
Mm.
getting into jazz, it seems like you're able to sort of explore some areas that maybe you generally work on rock, soul, mainstream, relatively mainstream music, but now you're sort of, you know, exploring these little tributaries. Was that intentional, or did that just sort of, this is what's coming to me right now?
Yeah, I think if I think about it, whatever record I was going to make was going to have those influences. I was lucky enough to go to West Africa back in the 90s and do some touring. And it was just a remarkable experience on so many levels. But the music really got into me, and it's been there ever since. Moving forward from the 90s to around about 1999 or 2000, there was a Red Hot and Riot album that I did a song for with D'Angelo and Femi Kuti and Macy Gray. And that was a remarkable experience too. We set up in the studio with half of Femi's band and half of D'Angelo's band, and Nile Rodgers playing guitar and Macy Gray. And we cut this song live, Water, which is a Fela Kuti song. Yeah, I just remember how great it felt playing that music. And, you know, I knew some of that music before, but hadn't had a chance to really play it like that with a full band, you know, like a 14-piece, whatever it was at the time. It sounded so incredible. It was so powerful. So that, I made a note in my head, I guess, back then, and thought I would love to do something like that.
Let's do that. Yeah, probably 3-4 percussionists, right?
Well, actually, yeah, it was with Femi. Absolutely, there was. I think there was a big horn section. We even had Roy Hargrove came in. So it was a really beautiful collaboration of Dee's band and Femi's band and Russ Elvado engineering. And it took most of the day to set everything up, and then it was over in two takes maximum. You know? Yeah, it was just a wonderful thing. And so that's where that's the sort of origins of that song, Ikute. I always wanted to do something like that. And I also did a gig in London under my own name at Ronnie Scott's back in 2011 with Chris and James Poyser and Tim Stewart and a host of other great guests. And we did a really slow version of Water, the Fela tune. I mean, super slow, and so I always thought it'd be fun to do a slow Afrobeat thing. And I was lucky enough to have Chris Dave to jam with. You know, when Chris Dave plays Afrobeat, it's beautiful. I mean, you know, we both love Fela and Tony Allen especially, and yeah, we just have fun with that stuff.
Yeah, you've done all these sessions for countless artists. Is there a great white whale out there that you're saying, I'd really love to play with this person?
Oh yeah, I'd drop everything if that call came in.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you, no, because that would jinx it.
But there is, that tells me there is one, right?
There's got to be at least one. There's one call he's waiting for.
I wouldn't say waiting for, but you know, there's so many people out there that I'd love to work with.
Fess up, Pino, you're dying to make a K-pop record.
Okay.
There's gold in them there hills, man.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Well, we have been talking to Pino Palladino. Giuseppe, his mom called him. It has been a complete pleasure having you on Sound Opinions.
Pleasure. Absolutely had a good time talking to you guys. Thank you for having me.
That wraps up our conversation with Pino Palladino, and as always, we want to hear from you. What's your favorite song that Pino's played on? And do you have a favorite bass player? Is there one even better than Pino Palladino in your universe? Let us know. Leave us a voice message with your opinions at our website, soundopinions.org.
Greg, what do we got on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we are going to revisit our conversation with Lowe, the band Lowe, in honor of Mimi Parker, who died recently. We had Mimi in the studio with her husband, Alan Sparhawk. Lowe, an amazing band. They played some tunes for us. It was a truly amazing conversation and performance by one of the great bands of the last three decades.
Yeah, really, and very poignant now that we've lost Mimi.
Absolutely, and don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Lauren Holt, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.
Me word, take the